You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Pip Smith takes us into the lives of those who experienced and witnessed the tragedy of the refugee vessel, the Janga, crashing into the rocks on Christmas Island in her latest novel, The Pool of the Moon. So, Pip, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you've correlated the movement of the refugees here with what is a natural struggle within the ecological system. And I'm going to read out what you've got here. In the very early hours of morning, 150 green turtle hatchlings dug their way out of the sand on Christmas Island. Exposed to the frigate birds circling overhead, the hatchlings panicked. They clambered over piles of plastic and rode through the sand towards where the moon splashed a path across the sea and followed its light, power stroking through the surf until they were exhausted or eaten or picked up by the southern equatorial current and swept out into the Indian Ocean. Most of the hatchlings wouldn't survive this first night, the most dangerous of their lives, if they weren't eaten by trevally or sharks or birds or snared by plastic waste. They would lose themselves in the open sea for years, diving for fish, hitching rides on algal mats before arriving at the Garden of Seagrass. Which garden? Any garden. If it could sustain them, it became their favourite. You've actually correlated what is a natural ecological event, and it's more than just the turtle, with the refugee crisis. What's the aim behind that?
Well, it actually came about when it was back in 2010, in January of 2010. I had freshly gained my certificate in teaching ESL, and I saw a news story about Christmas Island, and I also found out about a volunteer organization called Alive, and they had the contract to teach new arrivals in the detention centre at Christmas Island, and they were desperate for volunteer ESL teachers because I didn't realise it at the time, but part of our obligations to the UN were that we needed to teach English to people seeking asylum in Australia. And so the government farmed that contractual obligation off to a volunteer organisation. So I went there for 3 weeks and taught ESL in the high security detention centre on Northwest Point for 6 days a week for 3 weeks. They were very long, intensive days. And it was to the men in the high security, the maximum security centre, whereas the women and children were kept at the other end of the island in Phosphate Hill, which was, they were able to come and go, and there were people were able to sort of move more freely around. Whereas the brand new facility at Northwest Point was more like a high security prison. So I sort of wasn't sure what to expect when I arrived on Christmas Island. I had only really seen images on the news of barbed wire, and chicken wire fencing. And I sort of thought it might just be a bit of a rock in the middle of the Indian Ocean. But then arriving there, the thing that absolutely smacked me about the face was how vivid and alive ecologically this place is. I saw birds I have never, ever seen before. The frigate bird, when it's, fully stretches its wings out, is wider than a basketballer is tall, over 2.5 metres. The Christmas Island frigate bird is one of the largest, I believe, of the frigate birds. And they are just circling in the air like, Air Force jets. They've got these vivid, I was told when I went there not to wear red bikinis ever, because the frigate birds have these throat sacs, and when they're on heat they swell up, and so they'll get jealous. The male frigate birds will get jealous if they see you in a red bikini, because they'll be like, she's got two throat sacs. There were all these sort of things to be wary of, as well as the famous red crab migration that happens every wet season. Around December and the new year, when you know, thousands, they think 60 million red crabs will sort of emerge from their burrows in the rainforest and move down to the sea to spawn their eggs. So it's vivid, it's alive, and all this move, and it's constantly in flux. And the idea that you can build a fence and keep people in one place seemed so absurd amongst so much movement.
But that movement of refugees, is it a natural ecological event?
Well, I mean, I think it's dangerous to draw too much of a parallel between the refugee and animal migration. I don't want to dehumanize refugees at all, but rather elevate all human beings, whether they're refugees or not, like remind us all of our... We are all animals.
But there are forces.
And that we are, you know, compelled by, exactly.
Yeah, there are forces at play.
Instincts that are ancient. You know, people have moved for all time, you know.
Well, we've got over 10 million refugees moving annually today.
Yeah.
So it's an event rather than something that can be contained and disciplined and put behind a fence. But the other thing is, I mean, when you look at it from an ecological point of view, it's brutal because these hatchlings are being eaten, as you say, the most dangerous day of their life, succumbing to the elements. The turtle just goes off and leaves her hatchlings. So all of these associations, it's a brutal world out there.
Yeah, and the thing I was so surprised by when I started researching animal migration that intersects the island is that on one incredible night, I went to Dolly Beach, which is one of the beaches on Christmas Island surrounded by a rainforest, and I strung up a hammock and I slept on the beach, and I was woken up at 2 a.m. by the sound of someone shoveling sand directly underneath me, and I looked over the side of the hammock and there was an enormous green sea turtle who was digging her nest in order to lay about 200 eggs right underneath me, and I couldn't move. Of course, I couldn't sleep a wink after that, and watched her, you know, shuffle her way back into the sea again. That was a diversion from what I was saying before. I can't remember now. But that's right. What I was struck by when I was researching how animal migration intersected the island was that many of these animals are actually making exactly the same journey as many of the asylum seekers. So there's evidence to show that green sea turtles will traverse such vast tracts of water, even as far as the Persian Gulf to Christmas Island. Yeah, that is huge. And so turtles aren't maternal. They never see their hatchlings again once they've laid their eggs. But the strangest thing is that they return to the beach they were born on in order to lay their eggs.
But there's a parallel here because Coralie, the leading character in this story, is now from a broken home where her mother has gone off on another adventure, so to speak. So there are correlations and parallels there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't actually realize that until I was about 2 years into writing the book. I was a new mother at the time, and I think I was sort of, I realized gradually that in all the animal stories, they were also about mothers that get to the point of leaving the nest and flying the coop. And that tension between, you know, nurturing, but also needing to go out into the world and continue being yourself without your children. So I think that is a theme that is threaded through the novel.
Coralie, who's the lead character, and her mother and father are on the island. Dad runs the diving shop. Coralie's mum is actually doing research into the bats that were disappearing. But you've got another image here where Coralie's mum takes her to the jungle where Coralie's friends will not go. Why? Because she was too afraid of the ghosts. Mum and Ahmed seemed to be the only two people on the island who weren't. According to Coralie's best friend Cindy and the other Chinese kids at school, the jungle was crammed with Mei Chi Chai, their dead ancestors who were sold like pigs to work in the island's phosphate mines 100 years ago and died by the hundreds of malnutrition. The Chinese kids had rules. When you're in the jungle, don't say anyone's name 3 times or a ghost will possess that person's body. That's why you never really saw the Chinese kids or even the Malay kids playing in the jungle. They were terrified of the place. But that notion of ghosts permeates this story as well.
Yeah, there's a fantastic documentary called The Island of Hungry Ghosts that really looks at the presence. It is a presence of ghosts on the island because it's so upheld by the culture there. And the vast majority of people living on Christmas Island are Chinese Australians. And there is a horrible history, like the early history of Christmas Island is the death of hundreds of thousands of indentured labourers that were brought to Christmas Island for the phosphate mines. And so there's so many dead bodies on that island that were not properly buried and given a proper burial. So it is a haunted island, and you feel that when you're there.
Well, it's added to then by the Jenga that crashed onto the rocks. I think a lot of listeners could still recall that.
Yeah.
But the ghosts now become the psychological and emotional repercussions of that event for those that witnessed it, for those that actually survived it, and those on the island that witnessed what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a whitey, and I come from a very kind of scientific family, so I was not brought up to believe in ghosts, but yet I lost my best friend when I was 29 to suicide, and I am undoubtedly haunted by that. He is a presence in my life that has continued since then. So I think that has come through the writing of this book. I think even if you are sort of very much grow up in a very empirically strict kind of worldview, trauma creates ghosts, and the ghosts in this book are very much a product of the trauma that Coralie has experienced by witnessing the crash of the Jenga into the cliffs of Christmas Island.
Well, there are bodies thrown upon the rocks. There are people that have drowned. There are families, well, children that lose parents and such like. So it's not just an event that happens and then you move on. You have to deal with it. And individuals, people, deal with it in the most extraordinary of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially if you're a kid, how do you deal with that? A kid whose mother's not around, whose father is depressed and distracted and tied up in the crash, who's lost their best friends. How do you deal with that? And that's, I suppose, the central question that the book's trying to answer, especially when in the context of an Australian government that was hell-bent on silence around asylum seeker stories, which David Marr dissects so incredibly in his book on asylum seeker policy in Australia.
Yeah. But, I mean, Coralie, let's explore her a little more. How old is she? And therefore, what are the repercussions for her at her stage of development?
Yeah, so, well, when I first started writing the book, Coralie was 12, but then the infuriating thing about the publishing industry is that they like to have their YA characters at a certain age to be marketed at in a certain way. So I had to age her up, but in my mind, she's still 12 because, I don't know, 12 was such a formative age for me, and it was when I started asking big questions about the world and my place in it. But in the book, she's 13 going on 14, and she's at an age when she's finding a lot of her peers. I mean, the other unique thing about Christmas Island is there is a high school. But because there's so many contract workers and FIFO workers, you would make a best friend, lose a best friend the next 6 months later. So it must, and although there are people who have lived their whole lives as well. But I imagine it would be difficult to hold on to those close friendships. And so you're always having to deal with loss.
But it's that age where certainty breaks down. I mean, she has, lost her mother. Her mother's sort of drifted off on another venture.
Yeah, so her mother was responsible, one of the park rangers responsible for monitoring the pipistrelle microbat that went extinct in 2009 on the island. And so her mother is quite depressed in the aftermath of this and sort of goes in search of herself keeps promising she'll come back and doesn't come back.
So there's a haunting there, so to speak. But then Coralie's got to actually face the tragedy that she witnesses. And there's a lovely moment. One of the children on the boat, Zara, what can Coralie do? There's so much activity going on, plastic sheeting being put on the foreshore. What's that for? Sort of thing. What's the event that that Coralie has that helps Zara?
Well, Coralie sort of looks around and sees that all the grown-ups have no clue what to do. They're just doing what they think they should because they've never had to set up a triage station like this before. And she just knows, she sees a 9-year-old girl and she knows there's a packet of cards in the car. And so she's like, well, okay, I'll just go get those and play Snap. I mean, and she knows that that's going to be better for that 9-year-old girl than being fussed over by a bunch of nervous adults.
But that contrast in the face of tragedy is so essential, really.
A moment of connection.
Yeah, something real but momentary as well. But there's Zara who's lost her parents. There's Zara's brother, Ali. Now, what can you tell us about him?
Well, the book opens from Coralie's point of view and then we shift to Ali's point of view. So Ali and Zara are brother and sister and they've been brought to Australia. There's a history of their father being involved or associated with the People's Mujahideen in Iran. And so Zara comes to shore and she doesn't know where her parents are and she doesn't know where Ali is. And then when Coralie, who is gradually becoming more and more disillusioned by the adults in her life and how capable they are of negotiating a crisis like this, she decides to take it upon herself and goes into the jungle to search for survivors herself. When the boat hit the cliffs, she made eye contact with Ali and there was a deep kind of moment of connection there, but she saw he went up beneath the waves and didn't resurface. So she's sort of quite determined to go out and look for survivors herself. But the jungle is quite dangerous and she injures herself climbing this tree and hits her head and then is rescued by a survivor from the crash.
And these things did happen. You've got an account where Coralie's father previously had recovered refugees that had come ashore and got lost in the jungle. So this is happening all the time.
Well, yeah. So I should be clear that Coralie's story is completely fictional. That did not happen. She did not go into the jungle and she did not get rescued by an asylum seeker. But there is an anecdotal story that I included in the novel where so on the island there is the Volunteer Marine Corps and they're volunteers, Australians, that often were on the front line. And that's another reason why I really wanted to write this book after visiting Christmas Island was I realised the people in most mainland Australians are completely insulated from what's happening with asylum seekers. But the local Australians, of which there's only about 1,000 that live on Christmas Island, are absolutely on the front line. So this volunteer marine service would often just get the call out to bring in a boat. The Navy aren't there, whatever. The border force hadn't been constructed yet or invented yet. So they'd be out there. And I was told a story by a man I met who was a member of the volunteer group there. And so that story, that anecdotal story I've got in there of these men being called out to search for missing boys in the jungle was true. So I have sort of tried to nest in as many of the true stories I've found out about into the novel as possible, to sort of pay homage to these people who have been working so hard for asylum seekers.
Well, and at the risk of their own lives.
Yeah.
But also then at the risk of their own careers. I mean, Coralie's father ran a diving shop, but now with all of the asylum seeker and development, he's had to take on a job as a...
And that was sort of loosely based on another... So I interviewed a bunch of locals when I visited the island the second time. And I did meet a diving operator who went out of business because he told me when they started construction of the high security detention centre at Northwest Point, they had so many construction workers that all the construction workers actually filled every single available hotel room or possible accommodation on the island that there was actually no way for any diving tourists to book. And that was one of the reasons he gave me.
You know, the refugee industry has supplanted other...
FIFO industry.
Is part of the thing. And this leads into some of the broader questions. You've got an account of interviews with the asylum seekers. A lovely line, "You're asking the wrong questions," is the response from the refugee. What sort of questions were they being asked?
Well, when I was there, the question they were being asked is, "Did you come the right way?" So when I was there teaching ESL, I was gobsmacked by some of the things I would hear the guards saying, even just on the phone to their... A lot of the guards themselves were migrants from England, actually. The company operating the detention centre, I believe, are English-based. And so quite a number of the guards were English or from New Zealand or other, you know, colonial countries. And the things they would say, like, they don't even say please and thank you. And, you know, they came, if they hadn't come this way, they'd be fine. Or, you know, just some offhand flippant comments. So I tried to honour that in the book too, but I always worry that I've made that a little bit too extreme, because there were also people working for that company who were so compassionate and kind and really were loved by the asylum seekers that they met. So
you also go into the pantomime that was government, and that relates to the tamper, which sort of set a lot of this off. Has government got it right?
Oh, God. Look, I mean, no, but I'm not here to preach about what they've done wrong. You know, I'm not a non-fiction writer and I'm not a political commentator. I'm interested in the fallout from these decisions. I'm interested in how people are affected and all the sort of stories that emerge around those decisions.
But also those stories are so jumbled up. I mean, you've got this passage here. When you are surrounded by people who tell you that something you believe isn't true, even though you believed it was true so completely that it never even crossed your mind to doubt it, you will gradually start to doubt. Doubt the way you walk, the way you hold your hands, the way your face moves when you're listening to people talk. Suddenly, every gesture seems fake or wrong, like you're now being played by a bad actress who hasn't bothered to learn her part. And we're getting told so many stories about asylum seekers that we don't know what's true anymore.
Mm, yeah. And that I think that's another reason why I always knew this book had to be a book for... I mean, it's sold as a young adult book. My hope was always that it would be a book written, read and enjoyed by children to adults. But the protagonist always had to be a kid because that... or someone on the cusp of adulthood, because that experience of being so self-conscious and not knowing what's true, what's not, is what what the grown-ups are telling us. Is that true or is it not? Like, this, it doesn't gel with what I'm seeing and my experience of reality and truth. So that experience of suddenly doubting yourself and doubting the world you've been brought up in, I I think, sort of pervades the book.
But here we go. The psychology of nationhood. We, as a nation, are a child being told so many stories. What is it doing to us as a nation?
Good question. I don't have an answer to that question.
But if we're like Coralie, if Australia's like Coralie, yeah, trying to work it out, not knowing what the truth is, being fed a pantomime of stories, how do we separate,
tease
them out? How do we justify it when you've got the comparison then with the ecology, with the natural world and this movement, and there's a brutality behind a lot of the answers that we see, you know, the wildlife disappearing, an extinction, and yet is that the same thinking we should apply to people?
I suppose the answer is always just don't drink the Kool-Aid, always ask questions.
But it's getting a lot harder to do. The cognitive dissonance that's taking place about all the stories we're being fed, we actually need more novels like this to allow us to explore those issues. So I wouldn't say this is adolescent fiction per se, even though Coralie's, you know, 13, 14. It very much is a story for everyone to try and come to terms with or address or look at or find the story behind the refugees, which is an ongoing saga, an ongoing saga. We are actually going to have to end the interview there. We've taken the full show, which is a lot of fun.
I be able to just give a little
plug? Sorry, readings, go for it. Yes,
so
please.
Tonight, if any of this was of interest to you, I will be at Readings Kids tonight. I'll give a little reading and in conversation with Beck Kavanagh. So that's at 6 p.m. tonight at Readings Kids in Carlton.
And we will be going into resonant frequency radio as soon as I bring up their page on the screen. But the book is The Pool of the Moon. The author is Pip Smith. And it is, when I find it, University of Western Australia release.
Yes.
Yes, there we go. So, Pip, thank you very much for coming in and talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.